Healthcare reform goes before the court.
And the American people.
From APM, American Public Media, I'm Jeremy Hobson in Los Angeles.
And I'm Stacey Vanek Smith in New York. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org.
Coming up, what's at stake economically speaking as healthcare reform goes before the Supreme Court?
The military tries to go green without going into the red.
And if you thought ordering a pizza couldn't get any easier, wait till you hear what they're doing in Dubai.
Those stories and more coming up on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
Can the government force Americans to buy health insurance? That's the big question as the Supreme Court looks at the constitutional challenges to President Obama's health care law today. Marketplace's health care reporter Gregory Warner joins us now from the steps of the court. Good morning.
Good morning. It's freezing out here. I really respect all these protesters who've gathered to practice their chants.
Well, it's probably a very exciting day for them. But let me ask you, Gregory, what's going to be going on inside the court today?
So, Jeremy, inside the court, we're going to be talking about, or the justices are going to be talking about, the individual mandate. This is the requirement that all Americans carry insurance. So if you don't have it already through your employer, you would have to buy it. And this would start in 2014. From a legal perspective, we're going to hear the word limits a lot. And the question is limits on congressional power. Does the Congress, according to the Constitution, have the power to enter this health insurance market and make people buy insurance?
And obviously, healthcare is something that affects all Americans, or just about all Americans, from a financial perspective. What's at stake here?
Look, we've been debating this question for almost 100 years. 1914, I think, was the first universal health provision proposed. So, look, what's at stake here isn't just will this historic law be allowed to go forward, but it's also will the Supreme Court give the kind of authority to this law so that it'll be accepted by enough of the people? Consider this individual mandate we're talking about. I mean, what's the penalty for not buying insurance? It's not much. You can't go to jail. You can't get your house or car repossessed. So the law really depends on compliance. The economics of the law depend on compliance. Lots of healthy people deciding, okay, I'm going to buy health insurance. That's the only way that the health insurance market works.
Marketplace's Gregory Warner at the Supreme Court in Washington. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Now, some more information on the key term being debated before the court today, the individual mandate. Here's Marketplace's Amy Scott.
The individual mandate means most U.S. citizens and legal residents have to have health insurance by 2014 or pay a fine. And here's why. For insurance to work, you need healthy people to pay into the system to help cover costs for the sick. The Affordable Care Act requires insurance companies to cover everybody, regardless of pre-existing conditions. Health economist Joel Hay at the University of Southern California says without the mandate, people would buy insurance only when they needed it.
That means the healthy people will leave the health insurance market. And insurance will end up being only the sick paying for the sick, which is a complete unraveling of the health insurance market.
The penalties for opting out range from just under $700 a year to 2.5% of household income. To encourage people to buy in, the government will offer subsidies on a sliding scale. So if the court decides that the individual mandate is unconstitutional, what happens to the rest of the law? The court will take on that question tomorrow. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Well, for more on healthcare reform, let's bring in our regular Tuesday analyst, Julie Neiman of Smith Moore & Company. She's with us, as always, from St. Louis. Good morning.
Good morning, Jeremy.
Well, what's at stake from an economic perspective? There are a lot of businesses that have said that they won't hire if they have to provide healthcare for their employees.
That's actually kind of a cover. The reason small businesses don't hire is because they don't have any demand currently for their products. So when they actually see demand for their businesses or services, they're going to hire anyway simply because it means they make money, and that's the key criteria here. So this really is just kind of smoke and cover.
Well, let me get your thoughts on one other thing that happened this morning, which is we got housing numbers, the latest numbers on home prices from the S&P Case-Shiller Index, and it showed a further decline in the month of January.
Well, we're really seeing a bottoming out price process here. It is no huge resurrection for housing prices because we're talking going back to 2003 prices. We're down a third from our peak, but what we're seeing is stabilization, and this is in spite of backlog foreclosures, tighter mortgages, and very modest improvement in unemployment. If, what you have to look at, though, is this price segmentation. Housing is separating out by low income, namely Atlanta. Lower-priced homes went into foreclosure, but high-income areas like Miami and Phoenix, where you have vacation land retirement, condos are doing very well there. The Northeast is very resilient. They have higher-priced homes. So price levels that we're looking at, the damage is going to be in lower-priced houses. That's persisting. It's also due to unemployment, but the higher end is recovering.
Julie Niemann, analyst at Smith Moore & Company, thanks as always.
You bet.
Well, not far from the Supreme Court today, a couple of congressional panels will look at the military's push into alternative energy. The armed services have set aggressive goals to lower fossil fuel use, but now there's some pushback, as Scott Tong of the Marketplace Sustainability Desk reports.
Everyone is tightening their belts in Washington, including the Pentagon. So can it afford $400 a gallon for alternative jet fuel? That's how Republican Senator John McCain framed it last week. The military puts it differently, says Rob Melnick at Arizona State University, which does sustainability training for the Army. Take Afghanistan, where fuel supply lines are vulnerable. So why not try solar?
If you can bring power to the front line at the source, not from thousands of miles away, that's a considerable savings of both life and money.
Investing in new fuels is like cell phones, he says. The early prototypes are pricey, but they get cheap if the technology can scale.
That for every invention that someone puts some money into for a cell phone, there are thousands of Chapter 7s and 11s.
Melnick thinks the newest technologies, like replacement fuels, are pricey and more politically vulnerable. More competitive energies, like solar, he thinks, are less so. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
Now to the global perspective on business and economics. Britain faces the same dilemma as the U.S. when it comes to bailed out companies. When to sell off the billions of dollars worth of assets it bought from those companies at the height of the crisis. For us here in the United States, it's General Motors and AIG. For the UK, it's the Royal Bank of Scotland. The government there is talking about selling off a chunk of the bank, but it would have to take a pretty big loss. Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports from London.
The British government bought the bulk of the Royal Bank of Scotland to stave off its collapse. It cost more than $70 billion of taxpayers' cash. Now desperate to cut its deficit, the government would like some of that money back. It wants to offload some of the shares. The oil-rich Gulf state of Abu Dhabi is a likely purchaser, but the sale is proving controversial because the bank's now worth only about half what the government paid for it. Chris Leslie is a spokesman for the opposition Labour Party.
We might lose billions of pounds of taxpayers' money. That would be very, very wrong. And it would be better if we waited for the economy to recover, for the share price to recover, so that we got better value for money.
The British government could lose more than $10 billion by doing the deal now. But those in favour of the sale say it could stimulate more investor interest in the bank and help the government get a better price for its remaining stake. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Yesterday, Federal Reserve Chief Ben Bernanke said the economy still needs help, which probably means more stimulus, and that interest rates won't be rising anytime soon. Still, Alan Sloan says investors should be thanking the Fed. He's a senior editor at Fortune magazine. Good morning, Alan.
Good morning, Stacey.
So, Alan, tell me, why should investors thank the Fed?
Because thanks to the Fed, U.S. stock market prices are much, much higher than they would otherwise be.
And how has the Fed helped stock prices?
Because they did something that they called quantitative easing 2, which is fancy for printing money, in August of 2010. And in the 6 months after that, stock prices in the U.S. went up something like 28%,
wow,
adding $3.5 trillion, which a number of analysts who are not lovers of the Fed say is due almost entirely to the Fed.
Well, how do we know that that increase was due to quantitative easing and quantitative easing part two?
Well, you can't prove it, but you can't really prove anything in the stock market. But there's a fellow named Bob Wade, who's a very well-regarded analyst at Wilshire. And, you know, he attributes almost the entire six-month increase of $3.5 trillion to the Fed. And if he's willing to do it, I'm willing to take his word.
Let's look at the other side of this. How much has interest income dropped as stocks have risen? What's the other side of this coin?
5 years ago, before the world completely fell apart, you could get on money market funds and treasury bonds and CDs something like 5%. Now the rate on CDs and money market funds is essentially zero, and the rate on a 10-year treasury bond is under 2%, and you have to be an insane risk taker to own one.
So how does this shake out in the end for investors? Stocks have gone up, interest rates have gone down. Who are the winners and who are the losers here?
Well, the losers are people who have nothing but interest-bearing investments.
Very safe investments, in other words.
Right. People who either have to take more risk or lower their standard of living or eat into their principal if they're retirees. And the people who've won are people like me who have a bunch of stocks and can afford to take chances.
A look at the other side of the coin.
Indeed so.
Alan Sloan is senior editor-at-large for Fortune magazine. Alan, thank you.
My pleasure.
This week here at Marketplace, we're looking at how new technology is changing the American workforce. We're calling our series Robots Ate My Job. Think grocery store clerks who are now being replaced by those self-service checkouts.
My name is Jackie Gittemid. I'm a cashier, and I've been with Ralph's for over 35 years.
And my name is Ashley Schwartz, and I've been with Ralph's for close to 6 years.
I've been doing this for over 35 years now, and if I didn't like to be with the people, my customers, I would have chosen something else.
I was raised as a grocery baby. My dad has been with Ralph's for 40, he's going on 43 years, I believe.
And I, too, my father was in the industry for 50 years. So I'm second generation, actually third generation. My grandmother was a cashier.
I actually came from a store, a Ralph's store, that didn't have self-checkouts, and now they do.
They call them robots. Each terminal is called a robot.
So when I started working at this store, it was totally new to me.
At first, we're like, this is funny, yeah, sure. And then it got to be, wow, they want to get rid of us.
Oh, yeah, it's been awful. I didn't really think about it because I was getting such good hours for a while. And now I'm getting, you know, at the most 32 hours now.
And there's a lot of theft that goes on with these self-checkouts.
I had a woman come through self-checkout, and I watched her put stuff in the bag that she hadn't scanned, and then when it flagged the weight and I walked over to look, she insisted she scanned them, and it was such a fight, and I was dealing with four other stations. I had no choice. I just had to clear it.
To them, it's worth the price of saving labor is worth whatever people take. You know, what happened to people? We need people. We need that contact with people. We really aren't robots.
I could have, you know, when I first started, I could have wanted to stay in this job for, you know, my career. I loved it.
I actually went to college, and this is what I chose because I can change my schedule if I needed to go to school with my daughter. So people do choose retail. Those are not jobs that people choose not to have. And now I cannot go pick up and go somewhere else. And at 51 years old, quite frankly, no one's going to want to hire me.
You know, before this was a good job, it was okay to stay, but now it makes me want to get out of this industry because you don't know what the future holds.
And there's more on robots in the American workforce at Marketplace.org, including dispatches from Marketplace's David Brancaccio, who is currently driving across the country, Stacey, without interacting with a single human being, just technology. It sounds like a really fun assignment.
I know. I'm trying to convince him to get a robot haircut. Those exist.
To fit right in. Well, you know, there's something else that we saw in the news today that is being automated, but not necessarily for good reason. A pizza company in Dubai apparently thinks it's too difficult for customers to order a pizza by phone or online. So the company has created a refrigerator magnet, and all you have to do is tap the magnet and the pizza is ordered, which made me wonder if that's sort of
amazing.
Well, it could be dangerous, though. If you think about the way people, you know, are in elevators when they get impatient and they just keep pressing the button over and over again. What if you just keep pressing that magnet over and over again and all of a sudden you end up with 20 pizzas at your door?
Pizza.
Exactly. Or our engineer here, Bradford, this morning, when he heard the story, he said, oh, that's great. Then people will be able to leave their pets at home when they go on vacation and the pets can order pizza for themselves.
Just teach by the dog to order pizza. Oh, that's great. You might not know his name, but you've certainly seen his product. Sad news this morning that Larry Stevenson, the man who first mass-produced skateboards, has passed away. But where is the industry today, thanks to the development of Stevenson?
Here to talk with us about this is Michael Brook. He's here for our Midday Extra, and he is publisher of Concrete Wave magazine. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, tell us about Larry Stevenson and what he did for the skateboarding industry.
Well, to put it succinctly, Larry Stevenson was a visionary. He was a surfer who saw the potential of what people thought were toys. And he took a skateboard and he professionalized it. He made it something that was truly an experience rather than just a toy used by kids.
And skateboards, the way we know them today, were not around before Larry Stevenson?
Well, there always were kids, you know, taking apart their sister or brother's roller skates and bashing them on a 2x4. That's been documented from the early, you know, 1920s and 1930s. Hmm. What basically happened is kids would make scooters, and eventually the handle came off, and that's where you kind of got the idea of a skateboard. But in the mid to late 50s is when mass-produced toy skateboards came out, something called a ski skate. Millions were sold, but this was a small wooden plank with steel wheels. It really was a mass-marketed roller skate with a plank.
How big is the industry today, Michael?
Well, this is the big question that everybody wants to know because it spawned a whole bunch of other industries. When you look at the action sports market, which comprises of skateboards, snowboards, surfboards, all the shoes, all the clothing, you're looking at in the neighborhood of around $5.5 billion. Mm. Now, skateboarding is a big part of that by the way of the shoe industry. Skateboard shoes are an enormous business, over $1.5 billion. The actual skateboards themselves, though, tend to be in around the $500 million mark.
Hey, Michael, are you in Toronto?
I'm in Toronto,
and
yes.
And do people skateboard there like they do here in L.A., like Venice Beach?
Absolutely. In fact, I just came from a swap meet where a whole bunch of people got together. 500 people got together just to swap skateboards and stories and hang out and eat burgers. And I'll tell you, it's the phenomenon that Larry Stevenson started has spread globally. My magazine is in 26 countries. We are hearing from people from all over the world, from India to Afghanistan, all the way around to places like Russia. It's a worldwide thing.
Michael Brook is publisher of Concrete Wave magazine. Thanks so much for talking with us about Larry Stevenson.
Not a problem. Thank you.
The National Football League draft is right around the corner, but Nike has already been picked when it comes to NFL apparel. It'll take over the job of making uniforms and jerseys for Reebok. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports.
A week from today, the NFL will begin selling the new Nike team jerseys at a temporary pop-up store in Manhattan. Don Brown oversees apparel for the NFL.
With the tremendous increase in viewership and attendance at the draft, we thought it'd be a great idea, along with the new partners. The timing is sensational to have a new store, a pop-up store.
How much more was Nike willing to pay to get the contract away from Reebok?
I'm not at liberty to say how much they paid, but we'll see a nice increase.
Advertising Age has reported that Nike paid as much as $1.5 billion for the five-year deal. Professor Scott Rosner follows the business of sports at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School. He says the deal isn't just about money.
Nike's distribution globally is a lot stronger than Reebok's.
Some merchandise will sell itself. With popular players like Peyton Manning and Tim Tebow changing teams, diehard fans are already motivated to buy new jerseys. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
And finally, Jeremy, I have great news for you.
Ah, what is it?
It's from a study in the Archives of Internal Medicine, and it found that eating chocolate helped people lose weight.
Really?
Yes, and here's the best part. People who indulged at least a few times a week weighed less than people who only ate chocolate occasionally.
Wow.
And apparently the amount of chocolate you ate had nothing to do with anything. Scientists think that even though chocolate is chock full of calories, it also has ingredients that promote weight loss.
Well, I think I need to be over at a chocolate store right about now.
Because I know, we should go right now.
I'm going to start increasing my intake in chocolate at this point.
I know, it's the only diet that makes sense. I mean, swimsuit season's coming up, right?
That's right.
Got to slim down.
That's
eat
right.
More chocolate.
In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Stacey Vanek Smith in New York. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
This is APM, American Public Media.